Good morning, Your Honors. Kenneth Nackbar here on behalf of EMAC Worldwide, Inc. We are contesting the award of a $2.5 million interim attorney's fees to lawyers who prosecuted an individual claim by a former CEO of the company, Don Kurz, who was attempting to conduct a proxy contest to regain control of the company. In the circumstances, the award to the lawyers, who are the sole appellees here, was an abuse of discretion for multiple reasons, which I'll explain. The salient facts are critical, so if I can, I'd like to take a minute to explain them. EMAC had two classes of stock, preferred and common. The preferred stock, all of which was owned by Crown, had a $25 million liquidation preference and was convertible into common stock. Crown's preferred stock voted with the common on an as-converted basis on all matters except for the election of directors. Rather than vote with the common for election of directors, the preferred had the right to elect two persons to EMAC's board. The size of the board wasn't fixed in the charter, so it could be fixed by a vote of the stockholders, all stockholders, including Crown, by the expedient of a bylaw amendment. Now, the preferred stock had approximately 27% of the voting power, combined voting power, of the company. Coincidentally, Kurz and his co-plaintiff also had about 27% of the voting power of the company. So at all times, EMAC was going to be controlled by 46% of the voting power that was owned by the people who weren't Kurz and weren't Crown. It's also undisputed that the common stock was underwater. As Kurz himself admitted, it was, quote, questionable whether the common stock had any value at all in view of the $25 million liquidation preference. Based on trading prices, the total market capitalization of the common stock was, at most, $5 million. Stock was also concentrated. A few stockholders owned most of the stock, and they knew each other. In addition, some large stockholders were at all times supportive of and affiliated with Crown.
It wasn't always that low, though, was it?
At all relevant times, it was. It wasn't 50% of the common, but it was enough of the common that Crown had 50% of the combined voting power, and that's not disputed. Appellees admit that on any vote in which the preferred stockholder participated, Crown and persons loyal to it had enough shares to make any outcome other than a victory for Crown realistically unattainable. That's their words, not mine, and that's admitted at page 10 and 20 of Appellee's reply brief. Therefore, one alternative that was always available to Crown was to use its control of the stockholder vote to amend the bylaws, including to set the size of the board at three members. There are other things it could have done, too. It could have established an executive committee and, you know, required that its nominees participate in certain decisions. There are lots of things it could have done. But since Crown had the right to appoint two of the board's members, regardless of the board's size, Crown always had the power to assure that it controlled the board. And that is a critical fact. Now, Kurz was essentially fired in 2005. In 2009, he initiated a consent solicitation to control the board. The board responded by the exchange transaction that I know Your Honors have read about. And the thinking behind the exchange transaction was simple. If Crown had the support of 23% of the voting power, which it did, held by the common, it would win the proxy contest. That's true. The other side says that it made the proxy contest realistically unattainable. True. But if Crown had that support, it was going to control the company anyway through amendment of the bylaws or otherwise. Thus,
why did they want to do the exchange transaction? It sounds, with hindsight, like you're saying, well, you know, this was kind of a good idea, a waste of time, unnecessary.
No, the purpose of the exchange transaction was to prevent a lot of corporate maneuvering and litigation so that you didn't have a proxy contest, then a competing consent solicitation, one faction getting control of the board, the other faction then amending the bylaws and getting control back. It was exactly to avoid what happened in this lawsuit. And it's very, normally as an advocate, I don't say the court ought to look at things with 20/20 hindsight. I'm a big proponent of the business judgment rule. But this is a case where if you look at things with the benefit of hindsight, the exchange transaction absolutely was beneficial to this company and would have put the company in a much better place than it ultimately found itself, which was in bankruptcy.
Well, clearly, with 20/20 hindsight, we see there was a lot of back and forth. But what the vice chancellor said in his bench ruling is, you know, by abandoning the exchange transaction, I think his word was, we took this 27% thumb off the scale or whatever. Wasn't that the way he characterized it?
He did characterize it that way, but that was only for a particular election. That was the first shoe, but the second shoe was always going to drop, and it did drop. I mean, that's, look, what happened here is holders of 50% of the common, not the combined voting power, the common, exercise consents to ratify the exchange transaction. They wanted the exchange transaction. They didn't support KERS. KERS pressed on. For whatever reason, I don't know. We can only speculate. EMAC, ultimately withdrew the exchange transaction, crowned and delivered consents, shrinking the board. KERS said his slate won. The court ruled that his slate did win. That was appealed. In the meantime, the appellees here, BMF, suing EMAC at the time, entered their appearance in the litigation on behalf of EMAC, thus appearing on both sides of the litigation. The new board made KERS the president. They spent $800,000 of the company's money, and ultimately this court reversed the ruling of the court below, reinstated the old board. Before the appeal was decided, BMF made its initial $2.85 million fee application. The court deferred until after the appeal. A few days later, Crown, having been told that it couldn't shrink the board between meetings, issued new consents, again signed by 50% of the voting power. So this is the third time that Crown has gotten consent of at least 50% of the voting power of the company.
Clear something up for me. You've referred to BMF being on both sides. Was there any disqualification motion or anything like that raised in the record?
There was not.
Okay. So that was never appealed, and that's basically history.
It is history, but I think it does reflect on the fee application. In any event, Crown delivered consents of over 60% of the company's outstanding voting power, reducing the size of the board to 3 members as of the next annual meeting. That was March 4, 2010. So as of that moment, the handwriting was clearly on the wall. At the next meeting, the board was shrinking to 3. Crown was going to nominate 2 of them. Its nominees were going to have control of the board. That was foreordained.
We understand your inevitability argument, but let's go back to the exchange transaction and the vice chancellor's ruling. He attributed $1.7 million to the abandonment of the exchange transaction. He made an analogy to getting an injunction. And it appears that, you know, as this matter was about to be litigated, and the exchange transaction was abandoned. Now, earlier when I asked the question, you said it wasn't just an exercise in futility, it was worth doing, and then it was abandoned. And so what we need to focus on is this idea of a benefit. And you seem to suggest in your brief that it might have been a benefit to some of the shareholders, but not all of the shareholders, but to the extent there was any benefit, it was quantified at the wrong level by the vice chancellor. Is that correct?
We do say all of those, but we think that there was no benefit. And the reason that there was no benefit and the error that I think the trial court made is it didn't look at the overall picture. It looked at one sort of myopic opportunity for stockholders to have a proxy contest that was going to be futile. I mean, even if KERS won the proxy contest, which he didn't, but even if he did, what would it get him? It would get him 2 months on the board, or 3 months till the next annual meeting, at which time Crown was going to be back in power and was going to control the board. And that type of instability in the boardroom, and, you know, faction one is the board, you know, on Monday, and faction two is the board on Wednesday, and faction one is back in control on Friday, I don't see how that's a benefit. Now, if it weren't inevitable, if it were a different situation, fine, there could be a benefit, but that's precisely what the court didn't look at here. It was the inevitability that Crown was going to get back into control, and really only bad things could happen. And that's exactly what the exchange transaction was designed to prevent. Now, the court was openly hostile to the defendants and to the exchange transaction, and that's one of the big reasons why it was withdrawn. And frankly, Crown was going to get control anyway. So, you know, the board tried to do a good thing. It tried to prevent the instability that was inevitably going to result, and that in fact did result. The court was openly hostile to it. So the board, you know, felt it had no choice. It abandoned the transaction and moved on to the proxy contest, which it won. This court reversed, and then we had the fee award, and, you know, $2.85 million was requested, $2.5 was awarded. It was entirely disproportionate to any benefit, even assuming that there was one, and we don't think there was. It was entirely disproportionate to any value that could reasonably be attributed to the common stock, which, again, the court below didn't take into account. And as a result, the company wound up having to file for bankruptcy. It couldn't both pay the attorney's fees and continue to operate its business. Now, BMF was the largest.
It's my understanding that it's out of bankruptcy now, and this fee has been set aside. Is that correct?
That is correct. BMF was the largest.
The bankruptcy, is it your position that if there's going to be a bankruptcy as a result of an attorney's fee award, that the fees should not be awarded?
It depends. No, I think that's too strong, because, you know, you could have bankruptcies for two reasons. One is just a liquidity issue. I mean, I could have $10 billion of assets and no liquidity. And if somebody awards a $10 million fee for a $10 billion company and I don't have the liquidity, I go into bankruptcy, fine, and there's nothing wrong with that. The problem here is that there was no value to the company. This wasn't a $10 billion company. This was a less than $25 million company with a $25 million liquidation preference. And therefore, in my hypothetical with the $10 billion, if you went into bankruptcy, the holders of the common stock would come out with roughly $10 billion of value or something close to it. Here, the holders of the common, the supposed beneficiaries of the efforts of counsel that warrant a $2.5 million fee, they got wiped out in the bankruptcy. They got nothing.
What is the holding regarding bankruptcy that you would ask us to make that could be applied to future cases?
The holding that I would make is that the court must look at the benefit, and this is nothing new. You obviously need to look at the benefit achieved by the litigation. Here, the benefit was preservation of voting rights that could only install an interim board for a couple of months. But that benefit, whatever it was, can't be worth more than the common stock who held those voting rights. So I think what the court should have done is it should have looked at the value of the common stock, and it should have said, if the common stock is worth $5 million, which is what the record shows it was based on trading prices, then the protection of the voting rights attributable to that common stock can only be a fraction of that. Maybe it's 30%, maybe it's 50%. It can't be worth more than the common stock. Maybe it's 10%. But that's what the court should have done. And so let's say you said that the benefit here was $2 million. Then I'm going to award fees as a percentage of the benefit. 25% is, you know, a pretty good benchmark. You might award $500,000 of fees on that theory. What you can't do is you can't award $2.5 million of fees for protection of voting rights in connection with common stock when the common stock itself has an aggregate value equal to only $5 million total.
And when do you value it for this analysis?
As
of the date of the award?
Yes, yes.
And when you say you cannot do it, the obvious is you mean to do it would be an abuse of discretion.
To do it is an abuse of discretion. Absolutely.
At some point in time, are you saying that we do a cost-benefit analysis and perhaps voting rights aren't worth being protected?
Well, voting rights aren't worth being protected if the underlying security has no value. I mean, let's say we all agree that the common stock was absolutely worthless. It had no value at all. And you had the same lawsuit and you protected voting rights of common stock that could have no economic value. Let's say the liquidation preference instead of 25 million were 25 billion. And you had the same lawsuit. Would you award $5 million or $2.5 million of attorney's fees? I don't think you could. Because, again, you have to look at the benefit. Let's say we had confiscated the stock. Forget the voting rights. We just came in and we just took the stock. And then BMF filed a lawsuit and they got the stock back. And they said, well, we achieved something great. Their property was stolen. We got it back. What's the benefit? Well, you'd look at what the stock was worth. What was taken? What was taken was $5 million worth of stock. What they got back was $5 million worth of stock. Maybe they get 25% of that as their attorney's fees, and so they get $1.25 million. If we had confiscated the stock, if we'd converted their property, we didn't do anything like that. We did a transaction that was designed to prevent the very type of corporate turmoil that resulted. The value of that can only be a small fraction of the value of the stock here, and $2.5 million of attorney's fees is just disproportionate to what was an issue.
So this rule would apply equally well, in your view, with say a class action with a settlement agreement for disclosure of additional information for the stockholders, and then you apply this metric of the valuation of the stock to the award of any attorney's fees for that disclosure?
Absolutely. You absolutely must. You cannot, if the common stock is worth $1 million, you can't award $2 million of attorney's fees, because what that's going to do is it's going to wipe out the value of the common stock, which is exactly what happened here. And so what you're going to do is you're going to have these lawyers who supposedly benefited the holders of the common stock, and yet the result of that benefit was to wipe out the very common stock who they were supposedly protecting.
Are you asking for a new factor under Sugarland? How does this fit?
No, I think it goes to the benefit. I mean, you have to look at the benefit of the litigation, and the benefit can only be proportional to the stock. It's exactly my analogy. If they converted the stock and then they got the stock back, if you were looking at the benefit, you'd say, how much is the stock worth?
Well, I mean, look, following up on Justice Ridgely's question, I'm having some difficulty understanding why this is different than the disclosure case. Don't we often see a vote of shareholders 90% approving a merger, and then there's a lawsuit that says that the board breached its fiduciary duty by failing to disclose material information? There are attorney's fees awarded under those circumstances when both sides agree. And you look at it and you say, what was the benefit? 90% voted in favor of it after disclosure. 90% voted in favor of it again. What's the benefit to the
stockholders? Well, and I think in those cases where nobody changes their vote, the benefit is certainly attenuated, but still there is a benefit of being able to vote on full disclosure. My point is that if the stock is collectively worth $5 million, the benefit can't be more than $5 million, and it's obviously a lot less than that. Now usually that's not a problem because we're dealing with large publicly traded companies, so you know, some of Yahoo to $20 billion company.
But you've got a great deal of experience in the area. You think there's a that would disincentivize plaintiff's counsel to bring therapeutic claims that arguably improve corporate governance?
No, I don't think so. I don't note a dearth of incentive for plaintiff's lawyers. What I note is that...
Well, not now, no, but after your rule comes into effect, will there be an adverse effect on the...
No, business? No, I don't think so, because, again, most litigation is proportionate to the value of the company and the value of what's at stake. And, you know, publicly traded companies where most of this happens have capitalizations in the hundreds of millions, if not billions. I have reserved some time for a rebuttal, so I'd like to reserve that if I can.
That time.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I apologize.
No, it was your time.
Okay.
You shouldn't apologize to us for it. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Joel Friedlander for appellee Bouchard, Margulies, and Friedlander. I'd like to start by saying I think the lengths of the briefs are not indicative of the complexity of the issues on appeal. This court has recognized on numerous occasions that when fee awards are subject to an abusive discretion ruling, and that when the court below considered and reviewed the relevant Sugarland factors, that is sufficient to withstand abusive discretion. In this case, there's only one Sugarland factor that's being contested, and that's the benefit. And as to the benefit, the Court of Chancery made extensive factual findings tied to an extensive factual record, a record that was created over multiple court proceedings over a period of 9 months of active litigation. So when the court said, and the court below said, I think it was far from inevitable that things turned out how they did, or that rescinding the transaction fundamentally changed the corporate governance landscape, the court backed that up with numerous factual findings based on what it had learned from overseeing this litigation at every step in the way. For example, on page 93 of the ruling, the Vice Chancellor said, quote, as somebody who read all the factual record in connection with preparing for a preliminary injunction hearing, and perhaps I am as naive as the plaintiffs, but it certainly wasn't clear to me that when stockholders understood the types of machinations that went on here, that they would inevitably side with the defendants. And the court also concluded at the time, based on the preliminary injunction record, that disclosures that had been made by EMAX and the director defendants in support of the exchange transaction were false and misleading. And the court said, when you compared the disclosures to what was written in the briefs, and when you compared the disclosures to what was in the emails, there was absolutely no way that could be squared. But the litigation didn't end there, because then we went to a trial. And what came out in the trial was all the back and forth of the dueling consent solicitations. Actually, there were three simultaneous consent solicitations. And people put out their disclosures. And the court and ISS and Glass Lewis both came out in favor of the take back EMAX slate. And the court had the benefit of seeing those disclosures. So when they say take back EMAX put out, quote, meaningful disclosures that corrected what were false and misleading solicitation materials, the court was saying that with the benefit of a trial record in which all these disclosures were put into evidence. And when the court said, quote, as I think Mr. Deutschman testified, the Crown designee on the board, part of the reasons why they did the Crown consent, the board shrinking bylaw, was because they were worried Kurz might win. What's that based on? Mr. Deutschman testified at trial. They were afraid we were going to win the consent solicitation, so they decided to do the Crown consent. And then that Crown consent got invalidated. Your Honors affirmed the invalidation of that board shrinking bylaw.
And well, to address the specific argument that Mr. Akbar made on cabining any benefit or award by the value of the common stock, what's your response to that? Why isn't that a reasonable rule?
Yeah, there's a couple of really good reasons, I think, Your Honor. One is, I do want to make sure I get back to the inevitability, but the two reasons were, first of all, I think it would be horrible public policy when you have a small company that's willing to spend $5 million on its own lawyers, $5 million more in bankruptcy, to keep control, to say the lawyers on the other side aren't going to get paid. Because basically that means for small companies, directors can commit wrongs without any recourse. Because you know, basically you can't get a contingent fee, you can't get any kind of compensable, you can't incur the same expenses on one side that the other side is saying. And the vice chancellor went through that. He said, basically, you waived the argument that this is too high. When you spend $5.2 million, you waive that argument. This is not, you know, Mr. Macbar is an expensive lawyer. There were, as he said, there are five significant firms on the other side that we were litigating against. So that's issue number one as a matter of public policy. And as Your Honors stated in the Goodrich opinion, that awards are supposed to be carefully crafted to fairly compensate successful attorneys and encourage continued vigilance by the bar. You cannot have continued vigilance by the bar as to small companies if insiders can manipulate the process, spend as much money as they want to keep control.
Well, it is the logical extension of the rule he proposes then to not only limit the award to your side, but also to scrutinize the amount of money spent on the other side and perhaps get it back.
I don't know any legal rule that would prevent, for purposes like a derivative, like a waste case or something, after the fact.
That's the only theory that came to my head.
Yeah.
Some kind of corporate waste argument. Well, that you can't spend $5 million you don't have on your own attorneys and then turn around and say, once you've been a wrongdoer, the attorneys who pointed that out and redressed the wrong can't get paid.
Well, that's the irony here is our claim, when they say we sued the company, we brought a shareholder derivative claim, we added it on. But the company was a nominal defendant to get back these fees. Why is there money reserved in bankruptcy to pay us? Because we had a claim to get back the money from the defendants. And that's a derivative claim at the end of it all, but it's only because you had the litigation. But who would bring the suit in the first place? How there would be no legal fees expended because they would do their exchange transaction and nobody would have the means to litigate against it. Or they would do their crown consent and nobody would have the means to litigate against it. Because you can't even have the litigation if the lawyers on the other side can't get paid. So that's the public policy problem. The other is, I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the magnitude of this dispute. Why was so much money spent by both sides? Why was so much lawyer time incurred? And that's because of the odd nature of the capital structure of this company. The magnitude of the dispute was, Mr. Ackerman, he had this $25 million security that he had invested in, no dividends, it had no dividends, it had no liquidity rights, but he always said, I want my $25 million back, and there's all evidence in the record about the things he did to try to get his $25 million back. There was never an appraisal of the company, but let's just for argument's sake, say the company was worth $25 million, that Mr. Ackerman could get his $25 out and wipe out the company, which there was evidence that that's what he intended to do all along. So you can see why from Mr. Ackerman's perspective, he wants to get that $25 million back and wants to stop the common stock from getting in. And here's the thing. If the common stock could get control, if they could win the election, win the consent solicitation, and then implement strategies while they're in power before the next annual meeting, they can do all sorts of things. They can do an acquisition. We had a term sheet signed to do an acquisition of this entertainment company, Omelet. They could issue stock. They could do all sorts of business strategies to make the company more valuable. And indeed, Glass Lewis and ISS supported us again during the penalty of appeal when Crown was soliciting to shrink the board again at the annual meeting, because the argument was we can make this valuable for the common. And here's the key. Let's say hypothetically you could grow the company and leave Crown to the side. If you could convince people to do business after you get elected, you can pursue business strategies that allow you to keep in control. For instance, by acquisitions using stock and growing the value of the company to, say, $50 million, just to make it a hypothetical example. Crown's only rights are the conversion value of its preferred stock. So that 28%, their stock, they want it, they can convert to common and be worth 28% of 50. All the upsides with the common. If you can grow the company back to $100 million, which where it was a few years ago, they have 28% conversion value out of that $100 million. The rest goes to the common. This whole thing was about the future of the company. Will you allow Crown to come in, take control, use some transaction to trigger its liquidation preference and get out its 25 or as much of it as it can? Or can the common stockholders elect people who will try to grow the value of the company? And that's and Peter Ackerman may not like that. He'd rather get his money out. The common certainly would. So the stakes were very large. They were in the tens of millions of dollars. And that's why they spent $5 million to keep control, to keep out Take Back EMAC, and then spent another $5 million in bankruptcy. They wanted to cement control, and that's what Crown has now done. But it wasn't inevitable, if I can get back to that, because as the Vice Chancellor recognized, by invalidating the Crown consent, you now had this period of time until the annual meeting. And as part of the litigation over the status quo orders, while we were up on appeal, there was lots of litigation back and forth over the status quo orders, so that the incumbent board would always have a window of time before any Crown consent became valid, because using the record date bylaw, so that the board could take the unilateral action in advance of the annual meeting. So if our folks had stayed in control, there were various things we were working on, including this acquisition of Omelet, including firing the CEO for cause. An investigation was done about that, which would have meant rescinding his restricted stock, including you could have a supermajority bylaw of 60%. They could maybe litigate over it, but there's various things that could be done, and the Vice Chancellor explicitly said this in his ruling about all these are all reasons why it was not foreordained. It could have gone either way. And remember, the vote itself came down to one holder, the validity of one particular vote. And, you know, the world doesn't stay still. It so happened that we agreed that the annual meeting we stipulated would be 1 year exactly from when it was before. But there was no guarantee of that. We could have reached a different agreement. If we'd won outright and we didn't have the shadow of the appeal, the Take Back EMAC directors would have been in power for a period of several months, you know, without being hampered by a status quo order before the next annual meeting. So all this idea that it's always just in retrospect, just a silly exercise. What was at stake was control of this company for several months while the common stockholders and their designees on the board would have a majority and could pursue strategies to enhance the value of the company for the benefit of the common. That's what was at stake. So this idea that you can, in retrospect, do a valuation, they haven't cited any case for it. We've cited a string of cases. Voting rights are to preserve voting rights is a benefit. And that's in Amlin Pharmaceuticals, it's in Ceridian, it's in Yahoo, and you could add in all the disclosure cases. Voting rights, having a full and fair vote is a good thing. Elections are a good thing, as the free and fair elections are a good thing, as the Vice Chancellor said. And here, these benefits were so much more dramatic because they were in real time. We were actually fighting over the actual contest that was happening. In other cases, such as in Yahoo or Amlin, you're talking about removing restrictions on a vote that may affect a future proxy contest, a future effort to get back a majority of the board. And who knows if there'll ever be a future proxy contest. So here, it was actually ongoing. It was a real-time benefit. And who knows how it could have turned out. It did turn out, but I don't know any area of the law where we take this 2020 hindsight view. What is the magic date? Do we wait 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? You know, why would, you know, after any benefits achieved, the serendipity of when the hearing happens to be held? You know, if at their urging we had gone through a whole derivative litigation and then had another trial and then had the fee determined all in one big swoop at the end, then you look at the value then. It doesn't make any sense. The Vice Chancellor was following settled law and say, you look at the time when the benefit was obtained. And because you don't know what the future is, a free and fair election is inherently a good thing on its own because it's up to the stockholders then to determine the destiny of the company. And that's what mooting the exchange transaction, obtaining rescission of it, invalidating the bylaw, and then fighting over the status quo, we defeated their plan A, their plan B, and their plan C. So not only was there an opportunity to win the consent solicitation, and an opportunity for the newly elected directors to stay in until the annual meeting, there was also, through the litigation of the status quo orders, a window of time that the board could use, whoever's in power, by the way, to defend against Crown. We had a whole bunch of things we were working on doing if the appeal had come out the other way in terms of who won the consent solicitation. Their board, they also had an obligation to defend against Crown. What they did, by the way, was enter into a standstill agreement with Crown so that Crown could only put one of its two designees had to be independent. and the vice chancellor said we could have had another litigation over whether that's sufficient. But at least that itself was a benefit of the litigation. That that EMAC, seeing when they saw what we were doing, what we were planning to do to defend against Crown, they at least felt obliged to only allow one Crown to negotiate. Only one Crown designee could be affiliated with Crown. So that ultimately, the decision to vote to go into bankruptcy was not made by two Crown designees. Perhaps it's a small point, but it illustrates how the board had the power, had the window of time to use its authority to keep the preferred holder from taking control of the company unilaterally. And that's just another reason why this was not all inevitable. There was an opportunity for directors to defend against Crown, and there was an opportunity for stockholders to elect their own slate of directors, which could be in power until the next annual meeting, and pursue whatever strategies they were able to accomplish. The there are a couple of points. There was a mention at the very beginning, this is an individual lawsuit on behalf of Mr. Kurz. Well, it was Mr. Kurz, there's also a stockholder, SEMS Diversified LP. There's not an argument based on that because I think it's settled law under Tandycraft. An individual lawsuit can be get a fee for litigation obtained in an individual capacity. There's no requirement that it be a class action or that it be a derivative action in order to get a fee. So I think that's a non-issue, maybe just has rhetorical color to it.
Mr. Friedlander, to what extent does the record suggest the Vice Chancellor in awarding the fee to you that he did was influenced by the fees paid to Crown's attorneys?
Was influenced by what?
I'm sorry. To what extent does the record reflect, if at all, that the Vice Chancellor's award of fees to you was influenced by the fees awarded to the other side?
He explicitly said that. He said, there's an explicit part in his ruling where he said that he was looking at how much was spent on by the other side, and that when you see it's about the same, that's an indicia that it's in the reasonable, and that they've waived an argument that it was too high, given how much they spent, that our award was off by some order of magnitude, given what they had spent.
Well, is that an appropriate metric for determining a fee?
I would just say it was one of so many different factors that went into it. I think it was really in rebutting the argument that somehow too much time had been spent or that the fee award is too high. But remember, there's all the other Sugarland factors the court ruled on. For instance, crediting the amount of time we spent, the difficulty of the litigation, the complexity of the litigation, and the true contingent risk that we undertook in putting all those resources into this contingent control fight. So what he really looked at, so there's all so many things that he pegged the fee to. For instance, he referred to Yahoo and Ceridian as comparables, and he awarded an effective hourly rate, which is basically akin to both Yahoo and Ceridian. By the way, it's just not the law that the fees are tied to the value of the company when you're talking about the corporate benefits, or at least we haven't seen that. If that had been the law in Yahoo, that would have been nice when we litigated that. It was a $17 billion company at the time. And you're talking about preserving the ability to have a proxy contest a year later versus not. But what the courts traditionally have done for the corporate benefits is they've often taken an effective hourly rate, balancing the Sugarland factors, looking at the amount of time, looking at whether it's a contingent representation, and looking if a benefit was achieved. So I think what he really pegged it to, apart from all the factual findings about the different factors, he did reference the comparables of Yahoo and Ceridian and awarded a very similar effective hourly rate. But it just goes, in that 31-page transcript ruling, there are so many factual findings to support the fee award, both in terms of the benefit, in terms of the other Sugarland factors. And in order to win on abuse of discretion, they have to show that this was arbitrary and capricious and not the product of reason. But there's just one factual finding after another about why. So many reasons why this fee is reasonable in these circumstances on this extensive record for this very unusual and complex and hard-fought litigation, and including the public policy that this is litigation that should be encouraged. If you have insiders trying to take away an election and there's real loyalty issues, that's something that should be litigated. That's something that should not be foreclosed by creating some arbitrary rule saying, well, if it's a small company, you realize you can only get, you know, X dollars or one-tenth of what you might get if the company was 10 times as big. You know, even if it's consistent with precedent to recognize the amount of hours and the contingency risk and the difficulty of litigation, the complexity of litigation, the number and the standing of counsel. And often, by the way, in standing
the ability. To what extent can the bankruptcy be considered or should be considered? Litigation that bankrupts a company should be encouraged? Is that, that's not the rule that.
I think we should be straight with that. Litigation that bankrupts the company. As it turned out, the directors voted to declare bankruptcy. I think my opponents misunderstood the provision. It was not presented to the court below. If you award this fee, the company will go bankrupt. Okay. And they come back and say, well, there was a finding that this was a legitimate bankruptcy. But there's a lots of discretion that directors have about the decision whether to go into bankruptcy. And here, it served many of their purposes to go into bankruptcy. It cut off the derivative litigation against the directors and Crown. It triggered the liquidation preference for Crown and wiped out the common stock. So there were advantageous reasons for them to declare bankruptcy. And they spent millions. They spent $5 million in bankruptcy. So I don't think it's just, that's another part of, I think, the improper 2020 hindsight to say this litigation bankrupted the company. Decisions were made every step of the way by folks on the other side about the transactions they would do, how much they would spend to litigate about them, and then ultimately even the decision itself to file bankruptcy was a discretionary decision.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.